call and start the meeting, but we will start with testimony on your bill, Representative Morgan, House File 365.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and member of the committee. I appreciate having an opportunity to share with the committee House File 365. I have with me Superintendent Connie Hayes from Intermediate School District. It's 916, am I right? And I'll ask her to provide some testimony in a moment. Just a quick summary. When the legislature approved the alternative teacher professional pay system in 2005, the funding that went along with the system was a per pupil funding. And because it is a per pupil funding, there are problems when intermediate school districts try to implement or take part, participate in this program. The law says they are allowed to participate, but the funding mechanism doesn't work for intermediate school districts. And what this bill will do is create a funding mechanism that does work for intermediate school districts, to give them a realistic, practical opportunity to participate as other school districts do throughout the state. And I guess I'll turn now to Superintendent Hayes to talk a little bit about the specific problems associated with the current law and how this will fix it.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. My name is Connie Hayes, and I'm Superintendent of Northeast Metro 916 Intermediate School District. Thank you to Representatives Morgan, Greiling, McFarland, and Detmer for authoring this bill. 916 is one of three intermediate school districts in the metropolitan area. One area of service delivery we focus on is the most severely disabled students from our 11 member school districts and about 17 other non-member school districts. You might have seen at an earlier hearing a video produced by Intermediate 287 regarding the complex mental health and behavioral needs of many of the emotionally and behaviorally disturb students the intermediate school districts serve on behalf of the local school districts. That video and the accompanying vignettes testify to the challenges we face in our work in intermediates and the opportunities we try to provide for our young people. Another major program that we focus on at 916 is our career and tech program at Century College. Approximately 900 students each year attend the center for 2 hours a day, taking career-oriented classes, many of them getting college credit towards a program they may complete as post-secondary students. That's who we are as intermediates. The revenue at the intermediate school districts comes to us from the local school districts in the form of tuition and fees that are paid to us for services purchased. The alternative teacher compensation revenue in the current legislation is generated on a per pupil basis or average daily memberships. However, ADMs or average daily memberships for students we serve each year are counted at the local school district. And therein lies the challenge the intermediates have in participating in the alternative teacher professional pay system. No average daily memberships means no capacity to generate revenue under the current legislation. Our interest is to allow the intermediates to generate alternative teacher compensation revenue based on a per teacher basis rather than on a per student basis. How did we come up with 3,800? We roughly calculated what a typical district already generates on a per teacher basis by taking the total revenue generated and dividing that by the number of teachers impacted. This number would give the intermediates roughly the same amount of revenue per teacher as a typical school district already receives. One of the benefits of providing this opportunity for the intermediates would be some intense study and planning regarding how to make alternative teacher pay professional systems work well for special student populations. As you might guess, many of the students we work with defy typical evaluation of student achievement, either because of very limited communication skills or because they have severe emotional and behavioral factors that interfere with traditional testing methods. This kind of work at the intermediate school district could positively inform the work of local districts who must also consider special populations in their planning for performance work, only typically with less severe populations of students. We believe that we can work closely with MDE to develop strategies that will work with our populations and in the end will open some doors for local districts and they plan for this element in their own alternative teacher professional pay systems. Thank you for the opportunity to have this bill heard before the committee.
Thank you, Superintendent Hayes. Mr. Chair and committee, this bill will not change in any way, shape, or form the amount of money that is going into the alternative teacher professional pay system. We'll have to make those decisions independently of this bill. What this bill simply will do is it will enable intermediate school districts to have a realistic shot at taking advantage of this opportunity to improve their the way they deliver instruction and the way they deliver professional development to their staff. So I'll stand for questions.
Representative Morgan, now that we have a quorum, I'm going to call the meeting to order. And I invite you to go ahead and now move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move House File 365 for possible inclusion in the K-12 Omnibus bill.
Thank you, Representative Morgan. Questions for Representative Morgan or the testifier in House File 365? Any final comments from either testifier or Representative Morgan?
No. Thank you very much.
If you just renew your motion.
I renew my motion for inclusion in the Omnibus K-12 bill.
Thank you. I'm going to do the minutes. Representative Faust, we're going to turn to you to ask you if you care to move approval of the minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I so move.
All in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Minutes are approved. Members, we're just figuring out whose testifiers are here. I think we're going to turn to House File 1428. Representative Dabney is in the back of the room. Are you prepared to start now, Representative Dabney?
Chair Morrow, I'm waiting for an actual civilian.
Okay. Well, then we can.
Civilian?
Oh. We're going to go to Representative Rood then.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. House File 805, Representative Rood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You can give me just a moment here.
And as Representative Rood is sitting down, I will move House File 805 for consideration to be laid over to possible inclusion in the K-12 finance bill. Representative Rood.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. House File 805 is a bill to remove the inflationary growth limitation, which becomes effective with the 2008 tax levy. A standard cap applies to most districts. An alternative cap applies to districts that had especially high referenda revenues per pupil unit in the base year of fiscal year 1994. There is no cap for districts that qualify for sparsity revenue. Both the standard cap and alternative cap are adjusted for inflation. Under current law, the inflation adjustments for the standard cap and the alternative cap are the same through 2008. After that, the inflation adjustment for the alternative cap is lower than the corresponding adjustment that applies for the standard cap. So I hope you got all that. It can be kind of confusing. This bill would continue to apply the current higher inflation adjustment to the alternative referendum allowance cap. And this modification is critical to the long-term financial health of the West Metro school districts. It is important to note that voter approval is required to enable the inflationary increase, and it does not happen automatically. And, Mr. Chair, I do have a testifier here today.
Great. Thank you, Representative Rood. If you'd introduce yourself first for the tape and then begin your testimony, please.
My name is Dennis Peterson, Superintendent of Schools in Minnetonka. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is an issue that arose, I believe, in the 2003 session when the inflationary factor was put on into the formula. In Minnetonka, we had just passed our referendum in 2002, and so the new 2003 legislation did not apply, but there have been other districts in the metro area that have passed referendums with this factor included. For some reason, and I don't want to get into speculating why, the grandfather districts were capped at a 1% of increase in state aid after 2008. And so there's a recognition, I believe, by the legislature that there is some inflation that occurs, but that it would be held to a lesser amount than what the standard cap increase would be. As Representative Rood noted, all of these levies are passed by our voters, so they know what they're doing when they pass the referendum, including the inflationary factor. And the real purpose of an inflationary factor is to hold the buying power of the levy that the voters have just passed. It enables them to keep the quality of those dollars that have been assessed by voter approval in place for the period of time that that it applies, in this case up through 2008. We would like to see the legislature take out all of the reference to the grandfather districts being on a different factor and have that all be applied as you do with the standard levy, and have that be done, you know, for until this entire legislation changes, so it would not have a sunsetting date on it.
Superintendent Pearson, I believe that Representative Benson has a question. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nice to see you again, Superintendent Pearson. I will sound like an old worn record here, possibly. I seem to be going from committee to committee, suggesting that it's time that the legislature allow local school districts and local government to run their own affairs with less and less directive from the state or state agencies. And I just wanted to lend my support to Representative Rood's bill here today. This is a very high priority for those of us who represent districts like Minnetonka, Hopkins, and Wayzata. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rood, or your testifier, is fine. I represent very property-poor districts, and in particular, the Brooklyn Center School District has gone out for a levy referendum on four occasions, and it continues to fail. My question to you would be, how is it fair that we fund education allowing people to levy as much as they want when districts like mine, for example, can't pass a levy? How is it that those students are supposed to be competitive? Now, my kids are open enrolled in the Wayzata School District, and so they do benefit by the financial levies that you have, and so I do understand that. But my question is, how are schools like mine supposed to compete with schools like yours without a cap of some sort?
Superintendent Pearson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would suggest that it probably isn't fair. Brooklyn Center is in that kind of situation is a tragedy, in my view. It's not good for children in that district. It's probably not good for taxpayers, ultimately, but they haven't shown that understanding by their vote. But I wouldn't argue that that the situation you just described is fair. I would argue, however, that the way we're treated in the grandfather districts has not been fair in our view either. We have the same need to raise that buying power or keep that buying power into the future. So, and when you look at spending per pupil, the Minnetonkas and the Wayzatas and Hopkins are all well below the top 100 districts in the state. So, you know, we don't spend a lot per pupil, and yet this is one of the ways the legislature has chosen for us to get some of our money. Without a referendum resource, we would be in dire straits. We'd probably be in the bottom 25%, really.
Okay. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strom or Mr. Crow, could you just give us a brief explanation of when this would occur? If this were to become law, would it occur in the next offering of an operating referendum, or would this kick in? And then to what extent will it have an effect on property taxes, looking at your from most to least revenue per pupil?
Mr. Strong.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, a couple of responses for you. It would kick in for fiscal year 2009, which is taxes payable in 2008. It increases the cap, so the school district would need to separately have their voters either have already approved that levy authority or seek the additional levy authority from their voters. If you look at the printout that's in the packet, The school districts are ordered from highest to lowest referendum revenue per pupil. That's in the middle column there. The cap is expected to be at roughly $1,444 per pupil. You can see a variety are there at $1,471. That was the thinking earlier this fall where that cap would be, which is why those districts are at that level. If the inflationary increase is higher than the percent increase in the formula allowance, which it would be, that $1,471 would go to a higher number I'm not exactly sure where, probably in the $1,490 or thereabouts, probably $20 higher or thereabouts. And then in terms of your last question, the fiscal cost, there is a fiscal note in the packet as well, and you can see the proposed levy effects statewide on the second page of that document. And for fiscal year 2009, which is pay 2008, the estimated total levy increase on the bottom line there on line six is $154,000 in the first year and then increasing in the subsequent years.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Representative, Mr. Strom. Under local government costs on the fiscal note, the assumption is made that 10% of the potential new authority would be passed. And so that's what the fiscal note is based on, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, yes, that's
Thank
correct.
You. Thank you.
Other questions? Anyone in the audience wish to testify? Well, I'll renew my motion then to lay over House File 805 for possible inclusion of K-12 finance bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you.
Thank you. We're still waiting for one representative, so we're going to turn to House File 1428, Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chairman, while he's doing that, can I ask a quick
Please.
Question? Mr. Crow or Mr. Strom, on the referendum revenue per pupil, is that exclusively operating referendum revenue, or that include capital as well?
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, that includes only the operating referendum. Okay. The debt service revenue is not capped in a similar fashion. There's a limit on the total amount of bonds that a school district can issue as a percentage of its tax base, but it's not subject to a dollar cap.
Thank you. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 1428 to be before the committee for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Members, the more senior members may recognize this bill as a cleansing bill of 2005. At that point, an interesting and diverse set of interests came together, members of the business community, members of teachers' unions and others, to advocate for a new opportunity for school governance in Minnesota, self-governing schools within the regular traditional public school system. This is a model that is currently in place in some cities like Milwaukee, where they're having some interesting successes. Self-governed schools allow groups of teachers and parents to develop new curriculum options within the structure of school districts and teacher union contracts. Two school districts, Russell Tyler Ruthven and Minneapolis, utilize the grant program stemming from the 2005 omnibus bill. At that time, $250,000 was appropriated. Two $50,000 grants were awarded, and subsequently $150,000 canceled back to the state's general fund. The exciting work in Minneapolis is still underway and needs ongoing support. The inclusion of House File 1428 then in the omnibus bill would support the long efforts of teachers, parents, community members, and the district in bringing this innovation forward. With me today is Mr. Ritterson. Sorry, of course, I've only known him for about a decade. And Ms. Kate Toll, both from Minneapolis. Maybe Mr. Ritterson, if you could go first.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I want you to know that I've worked with this idea since we first heard about it about 2.5 years ago. So the opportunity to come and speak to it today is exciting for me. I was part of the original group in Minneapolis that got together and decided that we ought to take advantage of this opportunity to start some new schools because we felt that the loss of students through opportunities for them to go to schools that offered different ideas, different programs, was not only hurting us, but it was making us look like we didn't know what we were doing, whereas, in fact, many of the teachers, many of the principals, many of the other staff in Minneapolis have wonderful ideas about what to do with students, how to improve their performance. But when it comes to working inside a large bureaucracy, things don't always just happen because you have good ideas. One of the things that did help us along quite a bit was understanding that the grant was a direct, as well as the legislation, was a direct way for us to talk to the school district about how we can work together. And I think that it does promote the idea that school districts would work positively and progressively with their unions to try to move forward with ideas that are going to help students be successful rather than spending their energies arguing about how much and how many and how often. In addition to that, I think that the money that it takes to get any kind of a new program going, whether it's a program within a school, a brand new school, a school that's being redesigned, the amount of time like mine that would be put into that would cost me in time that I would have to pay for someone to replace me in my classroom, the additional time that it would take to go to a different city to see, to visit schools that are being successful in other places to try to get their strategies back and figure out a plan to put them into play. All of that is time-consuming, and that, in my line, is money-consuming. The grant was a way to defer that, make some of that possible, and we still look forward to the opportunity of doing that. As I said, working in Minneapolis, I'm working in a large bureaucracy, and as you're well aware, those kinds of institutions don't change quickly. It took us quite a while to get the attention of the school district. That school district, like many others, is beset with lots of financial and educational problems, lots of major issues that come up, and for us to come to the table with one more thing was simply one more thing until we had some money to offer to say, well, if we do this one more thing, there may be some way that we could get some additional money. That actually, even though the money wasn't a lot, was enough to get people's attention. That was important, and I think it's particularly important in large districts that we have something in this chaos of issues to get and capture people's attentions, and especially if it's something that can be as positive as we feel that the self-governed or the site-managed schools would be. So thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Please just introduce yourself first.
Hi, my name is Kate Toll, and I'm a very active parent in the Minneapolis School District. I also serve on the District Parent Advisory Council. And I was invited to be on the Bridge Committee for Self-Governed Schools last fall, and from the beginning saw it as a great opportunity. I have in the past helped to start a charter school, and my daughter attended a charter school for 2 years, and I elected to move her back into the Minneapolis Public Schools for academic reasons as well as practical reasons. But through that charter experience, I learned very much about the process of innovation in a smaller school and the need to have educational incubators, if you will, for creative teaching. What I like about the Self-Governed School Committee is the opportunity to bring together groups and build bridges where none have existed. We have in our district, as others have mentioned, it is a large bureaucracy, and this is a very, very unique opportunity. We have some teachers that are poised to be innovators. But this is within a context of a district that has sliding enrollment and that's finding it very challenging to compete with charters and private schools. We aim to remain competitive. There are some of us who want to continue to innovate and to have some economic support with that, if you will, so that we can create learning sanctuaries through difficult times and continue to foster that innovation. We've brought together the union, again, teachers, parents. We're even in dialogue with folks from the Humphrey Institute Center for School Change. Again, we see this as a unique opportunity, but we do need your support. Thank you.
Thank you. And we do have a question from Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for Mr. Strom. We appropriated $250,000 for fiscal year 2006 this year. And only $100,000 was divvied up between these two. So is that appropriation then canceled after the end of this fiscal year?
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, yes, that appropriation, the remainder cancels back to the general fund.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. And Mr. Chair, one more question.
Representative Erickson.
Representative Dabney, do you know to what extent the department promoted this? I realize it was only $250,000, but, you know, if we're canceling back the amount and, you know, now you want to pursue this a little more, do you know anything about their promotion, their marketing of this?
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, my understanding is that there was a handful or more of school districts that initially investigated it. There were only two districts who went forward and filed, submitted grant applications, and they were both awarded. I think if we think of it as a district-by-district thing, we may miss the fact that it's more of a school site-by-school site sort of grant, because with charter schools, the federal government comes in with a significant amount of money in upfront funding for them to get started. There's no such pool of money for self-governed schools within the public sector, and this kind of serves in a small way as that on a site-by-site basis. Mr. Chair, this does raise another issue. I failed to move a small verbal amendment, oral amendment, if I could. On page 1, line 13, insert $300,000. I thought maybe we should put some money into this.
$300,000?
$300,000.
Representative Dabney moves that an oral amendment to find 1.13, the insertion of $300,000. All in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
I recognize, Mr. Chair, that some people were hoping I'd come up for more, and I'm always willing to do that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Dabney, this is one-time money. Are you expecting more applicants, or are you expecting this money then to be divided among the two sites that already are participating?
I'm sorry, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erickson. There's a couple of things at play. My understanding is that others who have spoken to folks at Russell Tyler Ruthden have indicated that they wished that they had gotten some additional funding for the second year. To set up a school and get it started is costly and time-consuming and demanding. To maintain that also is somewhat costly, time-consuming, and demanding, and they wish they'd gotten additional support going forward. So we want to leave some space for that. In addition, there are several ideas that are still percolating within the Minneapolis district for different programs, different sites. So this could allow other sites within Minneapolis, or again, other sites from around the state or districts from around the state to come forward and try this. My experience is once you see somebody having a good idea and a positive experience, people get a little more gutsy on getting to the edge and trying new things.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think what we're seeing here is really important to move to site governance, and I was very supportive of former Representative Klinzing's bill originally. I hope that maybe next year we could have a report from the two that have been using these dollars for more than a year to see how well it's been working, because you're probably too early, Minneapolis site, to really report on specifics, right? So we can look forward to that next year maybe, or the year after. Thank you.
What I'd like to say about this piece is that charter schools take on a lot of risks, and what I like about this option is that it's a charter school with a warranty, if you will. There are a lot of benefits to working with a large district. We hear all the perils, but there are benefits such as, you know, teachers who are paid well, and have a bargaining unit that they work with, resources for transportation and food. You know, there's some supports there that I find very attractive.
Representative Demme, I'm just going to check to see if there's anyone in the audience who wishes to testify to this bill. Seeing none, did you have final comments you wanted to include?
Just one final comment, I believe, Mr. Chair. One strength of continuing this program is the relationship with the Minnesota Business Partnership, who were very much involved in 05 on bringing this idea forward and nurturing it along, continue to be involved down to the school site level in Minneapolis. And so that ongoing support and assistance is a value in assuring that we can come back in a year or two with a report and actual experience.
Thank you, Representative Davin.
Thank
there
you,
are no other
members.
Questions from the committee. This bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in the K-12 finance bill. We'll turn back to the top of the agenda now. House File 558, Representative Peterson. As Representative Peterson is seated with his testifier, just let the committee members know there were two bills on this issue. We were waiting for Representative Erdahl. Representative Erdahl is in another committee, so we may return to Representative Erdahl's bill at a later point during this meeting, but we'll allow Representative Peterson to proceed. Representative Peterson, I will move that House File 558 be laid over for possible inclusion in the K-12 finance bill. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your motion. This bill deals with superintendents and the phenomenon in rural Minnesota where more superintendents are being shared between districts. This would take off some of the financial stress in that. And as you can see from the bill summary, there's 20 districts that currently share a superintendent. The department's estimating that four more will come on, and giving the fiscal note at 1.0 plus million in out years. I represent three of the 20 districts in the state that are currently sharing a superintendent, and with me it is one of them who represents Canby, superintendent at Canby, and Hendricks, Lauren Hacker, who's driven down here today to tell us all about this bill and such and how it might be working in rural Minnesota. And also just interesting to note, I think in Lincoln County, which is one of the least populated counties in the state and one of the per capita lowest in income, I believe every superintendent right now is acting. And since I've been representing the district, I haven't had a long-term serving superintendent around for a while. So it is an issue, and if this bill could address some of the stability concerns in these rural districts facing declining enrollment, I'd appreciate the committee's consideration. So with that, Mr. Hacker.
Superintendent Hacker, if you'd please introduce yourself first.
Thank you. I'm Warren Hacker. I'm the superintendent at Canby, Minnesota, and I serve part-time also as the Hendricks superintendent. And I'm here to testify on this bill as incentive to encourage schools to move toward sharing maybe not only superintendents but central office staff. I believe as declining enrollment occurs in our rural districts, superintendents like myself and a number of them are looking at ways of maintaining programs, opportunities for students. And to do that is to do the first thing we learned in kindergarten, and that is to share. Unfortunately, as you know, in most school districts or even municipalities, when they bump up against each other, those borders can get raw sometimes. If you can think about being a mayor in two towns at the same time or serving two different sets of constituents at the same time that might be on opposite issues, I'm sure you feel that same thing. And this bill provides an incentive for small schools to begin that sharing process. A process that has happened in about 20 schools across the state, and those superintendents should be commended for taking on those additional duties. Like my colleagues kid me, why do you think you can run two when you're not sure you can run one? It's a challenge. There's a definite challenge because of those politics involved. The politics not only of in each district, but in the competing districts, and literally have competed for generations against one another, and that is one of the hugest pieces that you have to overcome, that parochialism that exists in small towns, not wanting to let go, wanting to preserve a past that they treasure and honor, as they should. But as we move forward with change, how do we facilitate that change? I believe by starting at the central or district office level that you probably can facilitate that change in a way in which patterns that might be set by the state government might be slightly different than all other local governments, that they would have an opportunity to create their own pattern, that they would have their own way of recombining. Setting up a timeline, you have to be done in 10 years, like I remember CNC monies. That timeline wasn't followed by all districts, and I think by providing this incentive, it will start that process and nurture that sharing that we should all learn to do.
Superintendent Hacker, I believe that Representative Heidgerken has a question.
Thank you, and more of a comment, Mr. Chair. Last year, some of you that were on the education committees, the governor had a proposal, and I think the superintendent, you may remember that, and his proposal was that school districts that that lie beside each other would qualify for certain funds. And it expanded on your concept where it wouldn't be just superintendents but administrative staff as well as, and it could have gotten either further. I think, Representative Peterson, you get a good bill here, but I think it would be nice if we could go beyond that, because when I see this bill, I know that within my district we have Minnewaska that's sharing the superintendent in Cyrus right now. And I have another school district over BB is looking at doing the same thing. But when I look at a small little town of Sundberg, and I see four different school districts coming into that town of 110 people, it would be nice if we could have these school districts getting together further than what they are just in superintendents. Now, that bill that the governor had, and I couldn't get it through the governor's head, I had a provision in there that made it non-contiguous. Remember that, Representative Erickson? We had a long discussion on that, because I could see how that would really help out rural Minnesota, but this is a good start, so this is a good bill. Thank you.
Representative Peter, Mr. Walseth?
Mr. Chairman and members, Sam Walseth with the Minnesota Rural Education Association. I'm here today to support both House File 558 and 153. I think they're identical legislation. Just a few brief comments. In a time of limited resources when we're all scrambling to keep dollars in the classroom, I think small incentives like this can go a long way to help small districts who are in severe decline to start looking at some administrative efficiencies that might free up a few dollars for the classroom. So I think this is good legislation and something we've supported in the past and we'll continue to do so.
Representative Garofalo. Representative Mark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have an important question here. Superintendent Hacker, were you the wrestling coach in Canby? Wrestling Canby?
For 2 years I did. I wrestled in Canby and I was the wrestling coach for 2 years, but I spent most of my career, 22 years, in Dawson Boyd.
Okay.
I believe that's probably also Representative Erickson's question. Representative Erickson.
We could go 2 out of 3 and we could see who wins.
No, actually, Mr. Chair, I wanted to wrestle Representative Marquardt, so he and I went through this once upon a time on a bill that I had several years ago. I wanted to ask the superintendent, what's considered a small school? Is there a certain population that entails?
Superintendent Hacker.
I'm unsure what a small school is. I don't know. We could ask Garrison Keeler. You know, I still live in Lake Wobegon. There are bad things that happen in Canby, but you know, I don't lock my door. Many of our constituents still leave their keys in their vehicles when they park them. You can believe that. That's a small town. And that's a small school. I'm not sure if we want to start looking at what numbers are for small schools, because our schools range from very small to obviously Minneapolis. And I can't, you know, there always has to be a break-off. I'm on the section State High School League Committee, and we just went through resectioning in all our sports. Mm-hmm. And so if you want to take the State High School League and ask you what a small school is, you'd have to ask me what sport it is, and then I could tell you how many students.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Well, I know all about that because Onimi and I went through that in wrestling, trying to become the Raiders, and oh, golly, that Minnesota High School League about drove me crazy. But I have one last question for you or even Mr. Walseth. Do you think this is going to be ongoing, this aid? Is there a time when we can let go and give it to others, you know, so that it's maybe just a startup cost and then we gradually let go?
Well, I can give you my personal
opinion. Superintendent Hecker.
I can give you my personal opinion. You know, I'm testifying here about reducing superintendent numbers, and I'm not sure even in your profession that you would rather would foster a bill to do that. You know, and so it's a struggle there when we talk about that professionally, but we're trying to do what's right for kids and what's right for small towns. My thoughts are that this should be the start, and we should follow it up with the only people that get, if you want to find foster consolidation, restart the CNC process, give dollars to the districts that are already sharing superintendents so that they have perhaps already a start or a pathway, and try to phase it out in that manner. I know I'm sounding like I'm asking you to chase dollars with dollars, but it has to be an incentive to get over that parochialism.
Representative Peterson, do you have any other testifiers?
No, I don't. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee for your questions. I think this is one of an example of what's facing rural schools, just in geography and distance, as well as declining enrollment. I mean, at some point, you know, the contiguous part or next to each other type district, you know, it's going to become, you know, geographically challenging or limiting, if you will. So I think, you know, this might be one approach to take to, you know, some of the struggles rural schools are facing, but there's more underneath this. If you say small approach to taking a little bit of the financial stress off.
I just want to check, does anyone in the audience wish to testify on this bill? Well, if not, House File 558 will be held over for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
We'll turn now to House File 1411, Representative House. And Representative House, I'll move that House File 1411 be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus K-12 finance bill. Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I call this bill is simply help in declining enrollment for Minnesota schools. It is a little broad-based, but it favors a great deal schools under 1,000. I believe and I hope you have in your packet a chart of all the numbers in different schools and how it will affect them. And I'll just jump at a few. If this bill were to be included, Sauk Rapids, for example, would get an extra $59,000 a year to help with declining enrollment. Carleton would get about $102,000. One of my schools would get $34,000. City of Minneapolis would actually get $99,000. Fridley would get $99,000. And there's several that wouldn't get any because they simply either don't have declining enrollment or they haven't had declining enrollment 2 years in a row. The formula for this is we're using 20% of the existing formula, so that's $994. Then you take and divide the average daily membership into a total of 1,000. We come up with a number. That number is what we use to as a multiplier for how many students you've lost and what your declining enrollment is over a two-year average. So I'll give you an example of my school district, Walker Hackensack Akeley. They've lost 34 pupils in a two-year period, so that's what it would be based on. They would get a little over $994 per pupil based on that formula. Now, some would ask, is this an ongoing expense? In a sense, it is, but in the case of the school district that I just gave you an example of, if Walker Hackensack would gain 15 students next year, then their average would no longer be a 34 pupil declining. And if they gain 34, they'd be zero. So it allows help only for 2 years if their enrollment stabilizes or it increases. Now, I believe Mr. Strom is in the room, and I did have a question for him to help the committee. I believe that our schools throughout the state have a problem with declining enrollment, whether or not you fix special ed. And I encourage you to make that your number one target, even if it means you can't look at this. But bearing in mind the membership of the legislature, and many people are in the metro area, I would much rather, in the way the formula is set up, by dividing the average daily membership into the number of 1,000, we're giving Minneapolis a multiplier of 1. But if you divide 35,000 pupils into 1,000, you come up with a fraction. And in my mind, Minneapolis, Robbinsdale, etc., are much more capable of handling the loss of 100 pupils than a school with 500 kids. And I would hope that you would look at how, if you do something like this, you look at that, because that's where it's really crushing for rural Minnesota if the economy shifts in any way. And I'm sure if Representative Rukavina was here, he would just be jumping up and down for this bill. And with that, I would stand for any questions if there are any. Or
questions for Representative House? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, then this bill will be held over 1411 for possible inclusion in the K-12 finance bill. Thank you, Representative House.
Mr. Chairman and members.
We'll turn now to House File 1565, Representative Welty. This is my big day. I will move House File 1565 to be laid over for possible inclusion on the bus K-12 finance bill. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House File 1565 will provide an additional incentive to school districts that are consolidating. Consolidation aid has not been increased since 1994, so this amount reflects a 50% increase in the amount of aid that will be given to school districts that consolidate. I arrived at this amount after asking the staff to calculate what the 1994 amount would be if they factored inflation into the aid amount. Just so you know where that's coming from, the GDP implicit price deflator for state and local government services is up 49% since 1994. So the current amounts that you see in the bill are increased from $200 to $300 in the year of a consolidation, and from $100 to $150 in the year after the consolidation. And now I'm going to turn it over to Superintendent Eric Bartleson from the Plainview Elgin Millville School District, which just recently merged. It was Plainview and then Elgin Millville, but the two joined together. And he will tell you about the consolidation costs and why this bill is needed.
Thank you, Superintendent Bartleson.
Yeah, Eric Bartleson, Superintendent of Schools at Plainview, Elgin, Millville. And thank you, Mr. Chair and the committee members, for allowing me to speak to you today in support of House File 1565. Just a brief background. I know you've got a lot going on today, but I've been involved as a Superintendent of Schools in Minnesota since 1981. And that involvement has been pretty extensive in school district organization and mergers. In the early 80s, I participated in the old merging or the pairing and sharing concept, where districts could give up their control over certain grade levels and combine them into another grade level with a neighboring district. The cooperation and combination legislation that was passed in the late 80s and early 90s allowed districts to get a plan approved by the state of Minnesota, and you would agree to cooperate and then bring forward a vote to consolidate or combine. And Lake Crystal Walk Memorial was the first district in 1991 to combine under that statute. So, and that also had incentives. That incentives that led provided dollars over a three-year period of time. And in 1994, the consolidation statute also added these incentives that Representative Welty talked about, at $200 per pupil unit the first year and $100 the second year. The CNC legislation led to a great number of consolidations in the 90s and overtook the consolidation legislation as far as the preferred method to combine. However, since 2000, there have been, I believe it's five consolidations involving 11 school districts, And in the last 5 years, there have been two consolidations, and both those took place last year with Russell Tyler Ruthven and Plainview Elgin Millville. Now, consolidations take place for a number of reasons, but primarily, and you heard them in a couple of other testimonies this afternoon, one is to maintain stability, and declining enrollment is a reality in almost all of rural Minnesota. The stability of consolidation provides that larger number of students to provide economic programming. Other reasons are to continue to improve your educational programs, and in today's educational world, the need for rigor and for advanced classes and for providing a variety of classes and courses for students is ever increasing. The last one is for cost effectiveness, and coming from southeastern Minnesota, that part of the state truly has experienced a lack of funding, not only from the state of Minnesota, but also from our local taxpayers. Right now, the Plainview Elgin Millville School District, you look at the October 2006 Department of Education disparity report, we rank number 299 of 339 school districts in revenue per pupil unit. And that's true for many districts in southeastern Minnesota. That's primarily because of the economics of the region and the reluctance, I think, on the part of many districts to increase the referendum amounts and get those passed in our school districts. As we came together in our consolidation, our combined referendum amount is just under $300 per pupil unit, which generates about $500,000 a year, which is very appropriate for our size district of about 1,600 students, and that really gives us some stability. However, the consolidation, and I talked about the reasons for consolidation, but consolidating is like a blended family, bringing together a very large blended family with different cultures, different traditions, and different ways of operating. And those translate into dollars as you look at consolidation and what we move forward with. So some of the things that we experienced in our first year, and we're just ending our first year, the $300 per pupil unit, $2 per pupil unit translates into $300,000. It's capped off at 1,500 pupil units. How we spent those dollars this year, I can just give you a brief explanation. It breaks out into four areas: academics, athletics, facilities, and technology. And in all of those areas, great needs were out there in our school districts and I think in many rural Minnesota school districts. We first addressed the academic areas and bringing the districts together with different textbooks, different reading series, math series, and so on, allowed us the opportunity not only to take a look at those programs, but also to how do you fund the additional textbooks needed when you want to combine those classes. So we took a route that seemed appropriate at the time. To take the least expensive route, we looked at used textbooks to bring things together for us. We still spend over $150,000 on textbooks in the first year, primarily in our reading classes and math classes at the elementary levels. We're looking at textbook costs of over $60 per textbook now in 2007, and I'm sure they weren't that cost in 1994. The other costs that we are experiencing was in technology, and the first one that we dealt with in technology was connectivity. The two districts had widely differing approaches to how we provided internet and email access to the districts. One district went through a DSL type of a line, the other district went through a cable modem situation. In the consolidation, we decided to upgrade that to a fiber optic system, and that ended up costing us, and it's under a contract, about $30,000 a year, and about $15,000 of that is now picked up through E-rate. But the real cost in consolidation and technology is bringing together the hardware and software that was in the two districts. And believe me, it wasn't just the variety of hardware between early Macintoshes and early PCs and outdated software. We could not connect. We can still have a difficult time in sending email throughout the district because we can't open it up in certain areas. So technology is a big piece. We addressed that last night in our school board meeting, and we approved our technology plan. And typically, a school of our size would spend about $80,000 a year in technology. We approved last night $192,000 in the first year. We appropriated the entire amount of the second year of the consolidation funding to that amount. So that $150,000 coming to us next year will go entirely into our technology. Another huge source of expenditures for the consolidation was in the area of athletics. And if you don't think athletics are important, come to rural Minnesota and experience what we have in any part of Minnesota. You can't pull together two school districts and expect them to be out there playing in the Plainview Gopher uniforms or the Elgin Millville Watchmen.
We have three different
And we have three different teams. We've consolidated our football team earlier. And so looking just at uniforms alone for varsity, JV, B squad, and junior high with T-shirts and cheerleading and dance squads, we spent over $65,000 just on uniforms out of our, again, out of our aid. We painting. You look at a building and you walk into a high school, any place in the state of Minnesota, you'll see their mascots painted on walls, the school colors on the lockers, walls, classrooms. All of that had to be, again, removed because we felt that we were bringing together a new school system. We wanted to make it feel like the Bulldogs with our new colors, and so those things all took place. Again, extreme expenditures in those areas. Facilities were the last one, and we looked at our facilities, and we had some real glaring issues facing us. One was in our new middle-level school at Elgin, a 7-8 school that may become a 6 or 8 down the road. But looking at middle-level education, there was no real media center that was supporting that system. So the boards decided we'll put together a state-of-the-art media center in that building. We took two adjacent classrooms, remodeled that, brought in a new lab, brought in all the technology for that media center, and it cost me about $45,000. So in our first year, out of the $300,000 in revenue for the incentive funds, we spent about $451,000. Now, that doesn't make a lot of sense, but we did have some other operational capital expenditure revenue available to us. But I think that the plea to you is to recognize that since 1994, all costs have gone up. If you want to encourage school districts in rural Minnesota to look at either sharing superintendents or consolidating, I believe that the incentive revenue should be increased, as Representative Welty has explained to you, and those dollars would then raise an additional $225,000 over a two-year period of time for our school district, which would really be a huge resource for us to continue on into the second and third year of consolidation. We've made very good use of our resources. We are now in our plan, in our second year of planning that financially. We've reduced one administrator at the building level. We've reduced some classroom teachers due to attrition and retirement. And we're moving forward and making the efficiencies that we promised early on in the consolidation a reality. But it takes 2 to 3 years to accomplish that, and the incentive funds go a long way in helping us to achieve that. So I'll end there and answer any questions you have. I know you've got a long agenda.
Representative Heidkirchen.
Thank you, Superintendent. And I have a question for you. I'm wondering why, and actually your major cost you did not bring up. Anytime you consolidate two schools, you tend to keep on faculty with the highest seniority. And because of that, you automatically pick up, your salary is going to be that much higher once you pair. The other thing that plays a big role in school districts that have paired is the severance factor. And that comes to play down the road a number of years after you have consolidated. Have you taken in any of those things into consideration?
Well, we're partisan.
Mr. Chair and Representative
Heidkirchen.
Thank you very much. Yes, we did. We looked at the attrition rate, and we're sitting in a situation, as most districts are right now, with a number of classroom teachers reaching retirement age. And so we factored that in and projected that out. And we do have a huge amount of dollars going into severance pay, and the retirement or the incentive dollars may be used for that. You know, we've chosen not to do that. They can also be used as a retirement incentives. Looking at our staff and looking at the retirements down the road the next couple of years, we decided to put the dollars into classroom and into the facilities and the classroom needs of the buildings. But you're right, severance is going to be a huge price for us, but yet we feel that the attrition, as it does happen, will not be replaced. We will not be replacing those people, so it will only be the severance dollars will be expended for removing those staff members.
Other members of the committee, any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lott.
Just one final closing comment. I received the fiscal note on this, and the impact for fiscal year 07 is going to be $116,000, and for 08, $290,000. If you look at the bill, we are including the school districts that consolidated on or after July 1st, 2006, so that would include Plainview, Elgin, Millville, and Russell, Tyler, Roofton. And then also the tails going on into 09, it's $86,000. Fiscal year 010, we're looking at $150,000. And then in 11, $75,000. So we're not talking about millions of dollars. We're talking about hundreds of thousands. But if you look at the cost savings after the districts consolidate, I think this is a wise investment, and I would encourage members' support of this. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Welty. And we do have a copy of that fiscal note in our packets. I just do want to check, though, to see if anyone in the audience wishes to testify in this bill. If not, this bill will be held over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Superintendent Bartleson. We'll turn to House File 668. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and actually, Mr. Chairman. And can I have the pages, pass these out, if possible? Mr. Chairman, I'll move House File 668 for possible inclusion in the K-12 Omnibus Bill.
House File 668 is laid over, moved for, to be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, there's two terms that be relevant that are noted in the House Research Bill summary. The first is the appropriation. That's the amount of funding that actually goes to K-12 education in this fiscal year or in the fiscal biennium. There's a different term called aid entitlement, and that is what we in statute designate will be going to the individual school districts. The handout you're getting, the tan-colored handout, is a history prepared by House fiscal staff regarding the school district aid payment percentage or the actual appropriation that school districts have received during their fiscal years. And you'll see that from 1971 through now, the number remains the same at 90%. However, within that time frame, it has shifted anywhere from the 90% all the way down to 80% at the end of in November of 2004. And members, what the bill before you does is what it essentially eliminates what one of my colleagues referred to, and I actually use this term now, as the Enron accounting of state government. And this does violate generally accepted accounting principles. The history of this measure is that back in the 1970s, when we used paper and pencil and didn't have accurate student counts, we would use 10% of this as a holdover to make sure that districts were not returning money to us. Your members of the committee will remember that earlier this year, I asked a Department of Education official if we could move to 95% without school districts losing money, and the response was yes. And in reality, my personal opinion is we have the technology, we have the updated information to move to a 100% figure, but in the interest of compromise, I accepted the 95% number. Again, I think the important thing with this legislation is that it does violate generally accepted accounting principles. This is a perfect use of, we have a pot of money that's called one-time money. This is a one-time cost to our books. Once we shift it to the appropriate level, we don't need to pay for it again. The numbers work out to roughly, for every 1% that we shift back, there is a one-time cost, or that we unshift. For every 1% that we unshift, it's anywhere between $60 and $65 million. The actual cost is dependent, of course, on the appropriation level that we would set in statute. And members, again, this is a one-time cost, and the important thing is I think many members of the legislature view the 90% figure as fully funding education, and in reality it's not. And to whatever degree we can get above 90%, whatever that number would be, I'd be happy with. What we are doing is taking an interest-free loan on the backs of our local school districts, particularly when we are at the 80% level. And I'd like to see us move beyond that level. And I would ask for members' support and would stand for any question from committee members.
Thank you. Representative Demmer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, my question is more for staff. Mr. Kroll, I would guess, would be the one. Can you tell us of the, they get the 90%, two questions. Number one, when does the 10% remainder paid to the school? The second question I would have is, and I don't know if you'll need to do more research on this, but how often do school districts have to make adjustments to their student count where they've actually gotten more than 90% of what they ended up getting for the year? In other words, if they hit it exactly right in terms of their enrollment, they get 90% up front and they're going to get a full 10% later. Later, when they actually confirm enrollment and everything's finished up and they get the remaining 10, that's when the balancing up comes. How often are they getting a full 10% and how often are they getting something less than that? And quite frankly, if we can get to the point of how often in a 95-5 situation would school districts actually end up owing back?
Mr. Crow.
Mr. Chair, on your second question, Representative Emmer, on your second question, I don't think we have data on hand. I could ask the department if they've looked at that at all. I mean, I would presume that 99% of the time it's wrong, either one direction or the other. It's going to be a 9.5 or a 10.5 percent payment at the end. But I don't know that they've ever done that kind of analysis, and I'd be happy to check with them. But it's not something we have on hand.
If I could, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dimmer.
So you said 9.5%, so it's really that close, though.
I mean, within a couple of
3 percentage points,
yeah,
one or the other.
Mr. Crow.
If we don't get outside of that 5% range, we would be in trouble
Mr.
that
Chair,
way.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dimmer, there are unusual circumstances when schools may close, particularly a charter school might close, where the 10% may not be sufficient. But in general, with school districts, their enrollment estimates are certainly within a percent or so of where they end up, and they're allowed to adjust those enrollment estimates throughout the school year. So during the course of the year, as they know how many students are there, they're making those corrections. So by the time we end up the year at June 30th, they've corrected throughout the year. So generally speaking, there's relatively little change on the regular formula for student counts. The bigger issues tend to be with payments for things like special education, where there may be tuition bills that come in after the year's close that aren't so clear. In terms of your first question, there are four what we call cleanup payments, and those payments happen in the months after July 1st through the beginning of October. There are four different cleanup payments to school districts to pay the remaining 10%.
Representative Denmark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you expand a little bit on the four payments and why there's four different ones and what they're paying for? And what would this, and if we went to 95-5, would the 5% be divvied up into four, as just like the 10 is divvied up into four? And what's the reason for four separate months?
Mr. Strong.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dimmer, there are two reasons for it. One is for cash flow timing purposes for the state's purpose. The second is that there are deadlines for when schools know more information. For example, many school districts won't have their pupil auditing done as of July 15th, so if the payment were immediate, they wouldn't know any more then than they did for the June 30th payment. So part of it is for the cleanup purpose reasons. Part of it is also for state cash flow purposes.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's another one of those eerie days when Representative Dimmer and I start thinking along the same lines.
I know.
The question, I think, for Mr. Strom, you explored with Representative Dimmer the accuracy, maybe the validity of the population estimates provided by school districts. Is that the same with enrollment reported by or anticipated by charter schools?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, the estimates have gotten considerably better in the last few years because of the changeover to the MARS accounting system, where we have individual student records assigned and student numbers assigned to each pupil. The reporting tends to be, school district officials and I presume charter school officials as well, tend to be slightly conservative on their pupil estimates, in part because a mistake the other way is much more harmful to them than slightly underestimating their pupil count. So I think what you'll find is when we look at the statewide totals for any school year, we find the collective numbers reported by school districts and charter schools are less than the statewide total, and that's consistent year after year. School districts report slightly fewer than they're expecting. The variations among charter schools are much bigger as a percentage, and part of that is charter schools are much smaller units. Anytime you get a small number, a small n, funny things can happen. The other thing about it is that students often come and go to charter schools during the course of a year. So that makes their enrollment more variable as well. So there is more fluctuation in those reports to the charter schools. But in general, again, just as with the school districts, the charter schools throughout the year are allowed, whenever they know more information, to submit that to the department, and the department automatically starts recalculating their aid payments based on the higher or lower student number.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Strom. Mm-hmm.
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, you'll recall that in our previous discussions on this matter, I asked Dr. Melcher regarding this issue and asked him regarding the policy ramifications for this. And the question I asked him was, absent political will, in other words, where we book the dollars to this, is there a reason why the department would have this be at 90%? Is there any policy considerations that would prevent us from moving to 95? And as I recollect, his answer was no. Mm-hmm. So again, this is if another reason maybe members may want to consider supporting such an initiative is, hypothetically, if you were in a state in an economy where maybe the economy was beginning to slow down and you were seeing slowdowns in housing starts, and perhaps next year in 2008 one looked into their crystal ball and saw that we were faced with a deficit, and that difficult decisions in the spring and early summer of 2008 would have to be made. If the education shift were above 90, a person could make an argument to bring it, if it was above 90, to bring it back down to 90 with doing no harm, almost sort of a quasi-reserve fund of what's been added. So just members to at least consider that. The important thing is that we I'd like to see us move beyond the 90 level.
Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Garofalo, has this ever been at 95% at any time, and why not? Hasn't it been at 95%?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dominguez, the documentation on state policies and intent in before the early 70s is somewhat hazy. However, the 90%, the 10% shift that was created in 1971 is generally recognized as part of the quote-unquote Minnesota miracle that was enacted. So previous to that, I would assume that there was not a 10% shift, because, again, the document provided by House staff says that's when it was created. The one-time benefit that a person would do when they created the shift was they'd be able to claim that they are increasing the, and I get the terms mixed up now, the aid appropriation to K-12 education without having a fiscal impact in the current year. But that's the one-time cost to it. And again, back in the early 70s, when we were using paper and pencil to document students, that may have made perfectly good sense. However, in the 2007, things are much different. Again, my preference would be we just go to a 100% level. There are certainly minor situations where that may impact districts, but as House staff have testified, at the local level, we're taking care of this already. And again, all we're doing is we're floating short-term loans on the school districts now. I like that term, the Enron accounting. I'm going to keep using that every time I talk about this bill. So that's where it's at.
I just want to check if anyone in the audience wishes to testify to this bill. Final questions on this bill? Well, Dodd, House File 668 will be laid over for possible inclusion. We'll turn to House File 521, Representative Heidgerber.
Representative Morrow, if you don't mind, we've got Representative Erdahl. Could we move his bill now?
That'd be fine.
I'll move House File 153. Representative Erdahl, we had a bill similar to yours heard previously here, and everybody kind of liked it so far, so it's up to you to keep it up, all right?
Representative Erdahl, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Heidgerken, as you know, everybody likes my bills. Actually, I'm sorry for confusion is the wrong word, but I was going to share the table with Representative Peterson. However, I have two bills up in capital investment and 40 people from my district who are attacking the DNR. And I couldn't tear myself away from watching the onslaught. So anyway, it's good to be here. And I will just briefly go over some thoughts that I have and probably echo what Representative Peterson was saying earlier. This suggestion was brought to me actually a year ago by a superintendent of schools. It has similarities to Governor Plenty's administrative district proposal of a couple of years ago now. Under current statute, all Minnesota school districts are required to have a superintendent. Sharing a superintendent is permitted under statute. For a couple of reasons, voluntary sharing of superintendents in some districts makes sense. It has obvious financial benefits. Two, three, four districts sharing one superintendent is cheaper. Small districts often struggle financially and would be incentivized and aided with a $30,000 appropriation. A second reason of sharing is if the job of superintendent has changed over the years. When I began teaching, and some of others of you, there were no computers. The superintendent acted as business manager, lunch program director, head contract negotiator, curriculum director, technology director. I picked up my VCR machine in the superintendent's office when I needed it. I almost said every day, but that would have been not true. And other responsibilities are taken up by other people. The superintendent now has a prime responsibility to coordinate others in positions that previously were in his or her purview. In some districts, it might make sense to allow districts to share one superintendent who could coordinate multiple districts. This is currently happening in about, I think, 20-some Minnesota districts. We estimate that this would increase about four per year, probably doubling the number that we have now. At $30,000, I think you have the fiscal note on this, you know what it would cost. This would lead to greater efficiency in some school districts, better use of manpower, save money for districts that most likely are small and would benefit from these factors.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erdahl, I really didn't ask this question of Representative Peterson, but I'm going to ask it of you. If this is a cost saving, why do we have to provide an incentive?
Representative Erdahl.
To encourage them to do it. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. It's, and that is a question in the bill. I mean, frankly, we do have districts that are doing it now without an incentive. I grant that. But there are more districts that I think would be well served to do this. And as with a lot of things, a little apple out in front of them, a way of incentivizing would encourage more of them to do it. And I think that overall it would be a good thing.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Well, Representative Erdahl, the fiscal note shows this ongoing. And obviously, it's going to be more expensive for the taxpayers of the state as more districts do this, which is good, but I'm afraid they'll do it because of the incentive. And I think that defeats the purpose. I think one of the purposes to share superintendents is to save dollars. And if each superintendent, let's say we're making $90,000, I mean, even in a small school district, that's likely, and the superintendent, let's say now, is paid $100,000. That's quite a savings for one compared to two. So, you know, I'm not sure I can agree with your logic on this.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Erickson. As I said, overall, it would lead to greater efficiency, use of manpower, and some financial savings to these small school districts. I do understand your reasoning, and I just look at this as one way to encourage it. If you have other suggestions, other ways to incentivize, I would certainly look to include that. I'm open to all kinds of it's my flexibility.
Other questions from the committee? Does anyone in the audience wish to testify on House File 153? Final thoughts, Representative Erdahl.
I just appreciate your indulgence and the opportunity to speak before you about this. There are school districts in Minnesota that would greatly benefit. Again, brought to me this idea by a superintendent. with that. Oh, I did have someone who was going to testify, but I think in the back and forth here, we lost him somewhere along the way. So I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Erdahl. As you know, we heard a good deal at the beginning of the committee meeting as well. So thank you. We will now return to House File 521. Representative Heidkirch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know that we're running over here, so the bill here is not very complex. I move House File 521 to be included and possibly be included in our final omnibus bill, but House File 521 has three different provisions, but I first have to offer an oral amendment. I talked to some of the School Board Association, and if you would take the bill out, line 1.9, granted to each staff member who is a veteran a day off, it should say a day off with pay, and behind that, in parentheses, a personal day of leave qualification. And I'll explain that in a second. Basically, what the bill does, it gives, if the school district, right now, if you're a veteran, if you work for the state, if you work for the federal government, or you work for the county, you work for the banks, you work for the credit unions, you all have a paid day off. Right now we have veterans that are employed as teachers that are working on that day. But within their contract, they have personal days of leave that they're allowed. And this would be a good place as another day of personal leave. I think it's a small gratitude to the veterans that have given so much. The second part of the bill has to do with providing instruction. Right now, if you have school on Martin Luther King Day, the school district is required to have a program in honor of Martin Luther King. This bill basically does the same thing, only thing it spells it out in a 30-minute segment. And there are school districts, if you refer to a handout that I have in your packet, within my school district, it gave me the idea is Deanne Johnson was chosen as a VFW Teacher of the Year this last year. And Minnewaska started their program in 2004. There are many school districts that have begun this program. And anyways, she kind of basically spells it out, and I'll just read that. Right in the middle underneath their picture, it says, these programs have taught our students about flag etiquette, different branches of the U.S. Armed Forces, patriotic songs, and how to respect and value our freedom. The children have been especially impressed with the military presentation of the colors by local veterans. With the positive impression she has seen the program have on local students, Johnson says she plans to continue to make it better every year. So some school districts have already initiated this program. It can be simply done with a lysine at the beginning of the day or whatnot all. A lot of school districts are doing it, and I know that there's one state that has thrown out observation of Columbus Day, a number of them, and Veterans Day was included, that being New Jersey, and the governor over there has just rescinded his motion to include, to continue the program for Veterans Day. The last part is the most interesting, that's where I want to get at. Okay, and it encourages private employees, such as the Walmarts of this world, if they have a veteran, to give them a paid day off. I, as owner of Charlie's Cafe, do have veterans that work for me. They will get a paid day off. And I think it's a small, small thing that we can do for our veterans that have given so much. And we have a lot of them right now. We have a lot of troops in Iraq. We have a lot of troops in Afghanistan, among other places, and I think it's a small little honor that we can give them a day off on Veterans Day. And right now we have the veterans back home at home and says, we're all working, we have a Veterans Day, everybody's having off but us. And I think it's just a way of bringing the issue up forth. Thank you.
Representative Heidkirch, I think first we'll turn, make sure we've got the amendment down, we'll move the amendment. The amendment that we have written down is on line 1.9. Yep. After the word pay, to insert parentheses, a personal day of leave qualification, right. Close parentheses. Right. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay. All in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Questions on the bill? Representative McFarland.
Mr. Chair, and I mean no disrespect here, but if the teachers that are veterans are not there on Veterans Day, why would you have a Veterans Day program in the school that day?
Representative Heidkirch.
Thank you. It's a good question. But, you know, it's they're already veterans, so I think that they have already made that sacrifice. And a lot of our students do not realize sacrifices that these veterans have made. And I think it's very, very important that our school districts, that all students are aware of the sacrifice that these people have made, they continue to make. These students right now, I know there are four of them just on my softball team that are at Rock right now that quit going to college, taken out of college to put their life on hold. I think it's a small sacrifice.
Representative McFarland.
Yes, Mr. Chair. My point is that wouldn't it be best to recognize their commitment to the nation in front of the students as good examples of citizens and possibly do this recognition on the day after or something so that the teachers could be there to be honored?
Representative Hiker.
Thank you. We could do that as well. Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Heidgerken, I don't mean any disrespect either because veterans are special to all of us, but in mandating that schools provide a Veterans Day program, I think it's much better if the veterans organizations, such as the VFW and the American Legion, instigates that, works with the school. That's what we're trying to do in Princeton. We're doing it to a certain extent, but we're trying to get into the high school and motivate the administration and teachers to understand what an impact this can make on the students. I think that might be a better approach than mandating this.
And the reason, thank you, Mr. Chair, the reason I'm doing it is we really do have that in law for Martin Luther King Day, among others. And I think it's a small offering to the veterans.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Heidgerken, then maybe we should make Veterans Day a national holiday that, you know, is applicable to all, like Dr. Martin Luther King.
Thank you. And some states are doing that. And I didn't think I'd go that far. I thought if we just have a little program for the veterans that day and it's not upsetting too many apple carts. A 30-minute program, a lyceum, they have the color guard come in. It's really impressive for all students to see.
We have Representatives Benson, Morgan, Dominguez, and Detmer. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Over your 1 minute.
I just want to support Representative Heidgerken's idea here. We celebrated Veterans Day in our auditorium or in the gymnasium every year. We had the colors and recognized the members who, in the staff, across the staff who had served the country, and the young people were very impressed by that. Mm-hmm. And I don't see any reason why a little patriotism hurts anybody. Thank you.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I, too, would like to applaud Representative Heidgerken's bill here. I just wanted a clarification, Representative Heidgerken. The amendment, the personal day of leave qualification, could you make sure I understand that?
Thank you. Some school districts, and they differ, some school districts only give a personal day of leave for something urgent within the family. Some school districts, if you look at the contract, have a personal day of leave. They can take any day as long as it has not to do with recreation. So I thought this would be just another definition of what would qualify them for.
Representative Morgan.
So in other words, this would just ensure that every veteran, regardless of what their contract says, this would make sure that it would qualify under whatever contract language they say throughout the state.
Yeah. Thank you. Correct.
Thank you.
Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Heidgerken, I also like this bill. It's high time that we get something like this so we can support those VFWs and American Legion so they can get some of that revenue when they have their day off.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I too support this. Our school does do this, and we put on the monitors around the school of all the staff that are veterans. And many times students will come up to me and didn't know that I was in the Army Reserve. And so it's a good program. And,
but you do it on your own. You don't mandate
it. I think it's a good thing to have. It should be retroactive. No, I'm just kidding.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize for speaking twice and asking a second question. But further clarification, what we're saying here, Representative Heidgerken, is that veterans would
they would actually take a personal day.
Yes.
And we're just saying that even if the language in the contract is muddy on whether or not this would qualify, we're just making certain that it does qualify, but they still would be taking a personal day of leave.
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
Great. And Ms. Schwab, Minnesota School Board Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, Representative Heigerken. On the new amendment that was added, we just want to clarify you're not forcing veterans to take personal leave on that day. That would, I think, maybe some language to say they choose to take that day.
Yeah. As it is spelled out in all contracts, a personal day of leave they do not have to take. It's an option. They have to request for that as they would here.
And second of all, can I encourage in paragraph 2, providing instruction to students, and my question would be curricularly, how are we, what are you looking for there? I mean, is there a way to say encourage these? Do you want to encourage local communities and school boards to discover what this looks like in the community? Do you want to see sample things across the state? What are you looking for?
It's been loosely ruled for that reason. It could be many different things. And it could be just a simple lyceum in the morning, a 30-minute lyceum, whatever. It could be a lot of things. And we saw that I know that I go over to Melrose every year and I teach Liberty Days. The Lions have a program called Liberty Days where they go around, and I don't know if Representative Erickson, you do that as well. At the Capitol here, we have the NCSL, that works with the Capitol, the states work together in promoting a program dedicated to liberty and to the veterans. So it's just, there's a lot of things you can do with it, and you let the school districts be creative with it.
Well, it sounds like it's a bill that's a great idea, but also maybe some changes that could be made to it in the future. But we will lay over the bill as amended now for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. I want to remind members, first I'll check, was there anyone else who wished to testify on this bill from the public? If not, I just want to remind members, we're scheduled out through the end of next week. Our time is filled in terms of our committee meetings. Adding bills at this point means bumping bills off of the hearing, so just to keep that in mind. And also, we're not going to be in this meeting tonight. We'll be convening in the basement hearing room at 6 p.m. for our joint meeting with the Property Tax Division. Great. Thank you very much, everyone. The meeting is adjourned.